Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, an examination of modern marriage and divorce. In Teffi Brodesser Ackner's debut novel, Fleischman is in Trouble, 41-year-old Toby Fleischman is recently divorced. He's just discovered the new world of dating apps, and he can't believe how much easier it is to find dates and sex than before he was married, and he's thrilled. But this is just one part of the story. As Brodesser Ackner told me, she's also interested in examining how well the institution of marriage is working, especially for women, as we strive toward gender parity. Teffi Brodesser Ackner is a writer for the New York Times Magazine. She joined me in the studio last week. Teffi, how great to meet you.
It is so great to meet you.
You are having really the time of your life with this book. The amount of attention it's gotten. What were you thinking about as you were writing it? Was it, well, this book will be okay, or my fondest dream is that everybody is going to shower attention on me?
I didn't even think about this part. In the writing of it, I thought about it coming out. I thought about it being on shelves, and I thought about what it might be like to be in a bookstore doing a reading. I did not think about the press for some reason, and I'm not sure why. Mostly because I didn't know if I would merit any. I felt like, you know, it isn't so often that you hear about novels so much anymore. And so I think maybe also out of a protective thing, because, you know, what if my peers are not interested and they don't like it?
Yeah.
But then again, I also see something, to be completely fair. I have a desk at the New York Times. My desk is in the culture section. I'm at the magazine. I do a lot of arts work, and I see so many books coming in. And the decision about how to cover things, I don't know how it is for everyone else. It's so overwhelming that I could understand that if I'm in your community and you see my name, it makes sense to give it a second look. And it makes me think about all the people who don't get a second look, who have great novels.
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking about this week. I'm not thinking about, oh, I must be amazing. I'm thinking about, oh, like the things they say about media elites. It might be true. It might be true.
So this is a novel about divorce.
Yes.
Something you experienced as a child.
Yes.
And I gather about which you have thought a great deal.
Or I think about it a great deal, but only in the way that I think about the fact that I have three sisters a great deal. It's just part of the water I swim in. And when I set out to write this book, the book I wanted to write was about dating. And it was about the fact that people my age who were coming to me when I turned 40 and telling me they were getting divorced were suddenly dating through these apps. And it was so amazing that suddenly they didn't have to show up anywhere. They didn't have to look good. They just had to sit at home and see how much attention they can get and decide while they were watching TV, while they were cooking dinner, who they wanted to go out with. And it seemed to me like a cultural revolution that I could tell a good story about through the prism of people my age who, when they first dated, it was back in the 90s or the early aughts, and they had to actually show up somewhere. And even back a step further, I thought it was going to be a magazine story. But my GQ editor said to me, you know, it sounds great, but the GQ reader has never known anything but apps. Like, he won't understand what you're saying. And I thought, sometimes I'm reminded that I was both older, a woman, living an unedgy life in the suburbs. You know, when I started writing this, it was a dating book. And then because it was a dating book and because I wanted to tell that story, it had to be a marriage book, because why was this guy suddenly dating? And then why was it a marriage book? Well, because it was a divorce book.
Absolutely.
And only then did I realize that all the things I had been thinking about for so long, they rose to the surface.
How did your parents' divorce affect you?
you know, I was 6 years old. How am I supposed to know? But I'll tell you this. My husband, Claude, his parents had a very happy marriage until his father's death a few years ago. And the only thing I have is a comparison to him. And the comparison is mostly that he is not as mean when he argues with me as I was in the beginning, right? I always had this kind of belief that if we fought too much, it would end. And it never occurred to him that our marriage would end. And so eventually in our early marriage, it stopped occurring to me that our marriage might end.
So somehow the fact that your parents' marriage ended put you in mind of, well, if I get married, my marriage could always end.
I'll tell you this. My youngest sister, my mother's divorced twice. My youngest sister was my maid of honor at my wedding. And her toast to us was she said, I hope you're both married a really long time. And everyone thought that was very weird because you're supposed to say forever at weddings.
But, of course.
But a really long time is a pretty good blessing in my family because there's a lot of divorce in my family.
I understand.
And when you look at marriage as something that can be opted out of, it's very easy to think of how to opt out of it.
So tell us about Toby. He's a doctor,
mm-hmm.
which in most societies, mm-hmm. one would think is a pretty good thing to be.
Maybe in a different time, it was considered a great thing for a person to be. It was noble. It was exclusive and elite. It was high earning. And it's still not bad, but he lives on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where he's surrounded by people in finance, and they feel so sorry for him that he has this job that's essentially like a good deed that he chose instead of choosing to have wealth.
And he is the one mm-hmm. who actually wanted the divorce. Why?
He asked for the divorce because his wife was angry all the time. When my friends were getting divorced, all the men said she was just so angry all the time. It didn't appear that they had ever really stopped to wonder what had made them so angry. But they were just so angry all the time, and they didn't want to live around this toxic anger anymore. The other thing that was interesting to me was that in the divorces I was hearing about, it was never said that the woman in the marriage was more successful or earning more money. However, it was always the case. And I think that we're at this critical moment where traditionalism is intersecting with ambition. And there are women who are told from the time they're girls that you could be whatever you want to be, but nobody told the men. And so we have all these men in our lives who think they're feminists and they think they're doing this great job, but they never thought ahead to, well, you know, my mother was always standing at the door with a martini when my
exactly.
father walked through
exactly.
the door. No one has a martini for me anymore. Am I supposed to be carrying the martini? Why isn't there a martini? Why isn't anyone having a martini?
Why isn't she waiting at the door for me?
Why isn't she waiting for me at the
door?
And
she has her own life. She's got her own very demanding job.
And she's exhausted when she gets home. And then she also has the kids. And he has the kids, and he does equal work with the kids, but he doesn't do the behind-the-scenes work. And also, he gets so disproportionately congratulated for the things that he does, whereas she has to go to this certain Pilates class every week so that she could be in with the right mothers. And that's how the play dates get set up. And that is how you get invited to the music class. And that's how you get invited to the weekend at the ski house. And she's doing it because she never had friends growing up and she wanted her kids to have the same kind of friends. Her ambition everywhere is what leads to her ruin.
So in the beginning of Fleischman is in trouble, the wife disappears.
Yes.
And she drops the two kids off at Toby's apartment without any forewarning.
It's his weekend, but it starts tomorrow.
Right.
And she drops them off like at 4 a.m. because she's heard that a spot at a yoga retreat has opened up and she just needs some me time. And he's angry because all her time is her time, is what he thinks. And then Sunday night comes and she does not come back. And Monday comes and Tuesday comes and she just doesn't come back.
I mean, his life had been one where he was sort of really thinking, you know, this is okay.
Yeah.
I can do this.
Right.
And there are all these women after
right.
me.
Right.
And he was having a great time. And then she doesn't show up.
Right. You know, I don't think about this very often, but it reminds me, my father used to take us every single weekend, no matter what. And people would always say to us, his friends, his family, you're so lucky that your father takes you every weekend, because there were so many divorced fathers who didn't take their kids
who
every other weekend.
Bother.
Yeah.
I mean,
we're his children.
Yes.
He had such a good deal. He was taking us for the fun part, for movies and for restaurant meals.
And was your mother getting the same accolades?
No, my mother was expected to do everything. And why was she so angry all the time, he wanted to know. And she had to do the thankless work of making sure our homework was done, making sure we were on time for school every day. And it was completely unjust. And I didn't realize it at the time. I just thought it was so much more fun to be with my father, which is really unfair.
Did you get to talk to your mother about this?
My mother has been reading the book for a year now, which is to say that she's trying.
And she's reading this book. Is she talking to you about what she's reading?
She understands in a way that most people don't. Most people wonder about my marriage when they see that I've written a book like this. But she knows the plot. She knows the storylines. And she never left us, certainly. That was the thing. She never left. She was there every single day. She was there every single day when we got home. But she says it's very hard to see all my thoughts about it written down. It's like facing your accuser a little bit, I guess. But I don't know, because I don't accuse her. But I think it was very hard. I think she heard from me all my life growing up until I was old enough to know better, that I wish she could be more fun like Dad, you know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So how did the fact that she came here and then became a passionate Orthodox Jew.
Oh, yes.
How did that affect your lifestyle?
If you had asked me before I wrote a book about divorce what the most profound thing that ever happened in my life was, it would be that my mother and then my three sisters became Orthodox. It changed my life more than the divorce. It changed my life so completely.
How so?
You know, I wasn't in a Jewish school, but I could no longer eat with my friends. I couldn't answer the phone on Friday nights. I was suddenly taking days off from school. My mother didn't want me eating the cafeteria food because it wasn't kosher. I was 12 years old. And as if that's not a hard enough time, I was given this whole new set of things that made me different. And I also didn't understand why this was all necessary. I remember very specifically saying to my sisters, you know, she's had her fun her whole life. And she has four daughters and they're about to become teenagers and she's locking us down. And they were like, yes, but it's great. And I could not imagine why any American girl had not by then thought that she had been told by so many people how to live her life by then that she was still willing to accept new opinions.
It was during this very time when your mother was imposing all these rules that you and your sister, I gather, discovered Philip Roth.
Yes.
And
yes.
What was the first Philip Roth you read? Portnoy's Complaint?
It was Goodbye Columbus,
uh-huh.
which is a good gateway because
yeah.
it's only a little shocking. And then it leads you straight into Portnoy, of
yeah.
course. And
yeah.
then by then you're gone. Nothing will ever be good enough. Nothing will ever be dirty enough. And, you know, I loved it.
And this book of yours has been compared a great deal to the writings of Philip Roth.
I mean, I don't even know what to say about that. Except that I think that maybe the thing that has the most influence over you the way my sisters began to take on my mother's voice in terms of their values, I took on someone else's voice in terms of values.
So I open the book and I begin reading, and what pops out are words that we won't use on the air, and descriptions of women who send photographs of themselves to him.
Yes.
And he's loving it.
Yes, he does
love it. He is thinking, you know, I've died and gone to heaven. Now that I'm divorced, I'm free to do whatever I want. So as we get further into the novel, and his wife is missing, how does he change in the process?
He grows more and more resentful. He does not look for answers. He looks for cover-ups. He tries to manage. He convinces one of his children, who's very reluctant, to go to camp, to sleepaway camp, lest they notice that their mother isn't there anymore. He is incapable of having a confrontation, but also he views himself as a very noble character, and it's up to you to decide if he is. But he is thwarted. Every time he gets one of these new pictures to his phone, someone else calls or a kid needs him. And he feels like if he could just get a running start, he'd be off and he could have the summer of Toby Fleischman that he always wanted.
So why did you make this his story?
As opposed to a woman's? Because the men I know who let me look at their phones were having a glorious time, whereas the women were having a miserable time.
And you're talking here about the separated and divorced.
Yeah, I'm talking about the separated and divorced who are now dating using apps.
Right.
And the women were trying to negotiate sometimes very tone-deaf, aggressive sexual requests, pictures that they did not welcome, and a kind of entitlement through the marketing copy that is your introduction to a person. A friend of mine came to my house to change her clothing for her date. She didn't want her kids to see. And I said, who are you going on a date with? And she showed me her phone, and she showed me his kind of come hither description. And this is what it was. It was, I'm so tired of manipulative women. My wife was a total head case. If you're into playing games, I'm not interested. But if you're not, I'm willing to meet you. And I said to my friend, why are you going out with him? And she said, there is not really much else out there. I mean, she was, of course, in the suburbs, or she was defining the very, very narrow terms of what she was willing to go out with. She didn't want to go out with a 25-year-old. She didn't want to go out with someone who was still married. She didn't want to go out with someone who was looking for a polyamorous situation, right? And she is finding that there are slim pickings for the women. And it just seemed, you know, I'm a journalist. I write about real things all the time. I write about actual human pain all the time. But I was at GQ for a few years. And can I tell you how fun it is to write about men? Men, despite the revolution, men are still having an incredibly easy time in this world. And as a foray into fiction, it meant a lot to me to sit beside and narrate somebody's very good time for a few minutes.
A quick break. When we come back, more from Taffy Brodesser-Ackner.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Taffy Brodesser-Ackner. Her new novel is titled Fleischman is in Trouble. At this point, why don't you read that section?
Okay, I'll read it.
Set it up for us.
Okay. We find out that this novel is not being told by an omniscient narrator. We find out that it's being narrated by Toby's very old friend, who is a married woman who lives in New Jersey, who recently left her men's magazine job and decided to hang up her ambition instead of pursuing anything else. And when Toby calls her to tell her that he is divorced, it ignites in her a kind of, you know, someone recently described it, my editor's assistant recently described it as a rumspringa from her own marriage. Even though she does not leave her own marriage, she begins spending a lot of time with Toby.
With Toby.
So in this section, this is very close to the beginning, and she describes who she is and how she ended up that way.
Good.
I was going through something right then, too. I had left my job as a staff writer for a men's magazine about 2 years before. I was now what was called a stay-at-home mother, a temporary occupation with no prospect of promotion that worked so hard to differentiate itself from job working that it confined me to semantic house arrest, though certainly I was allowed to carpool and go to the store. When I told people what I did, they'd say, "Being a mother is the hardest job there is." But it wasn't. The hardest job there was being a mother and having an actual job with pants and a commuter train pass and pens and lipstick. Back when I had a job, no one ever said to me, "Having an actual job and being a mother is the hardest job there is." We had to not say those things so that we could tiptoe around all the feelings of inadequacy that we projected onto the stay-at-home mothers. In fact, you couldn't even ask a woman you suspected of stay-at-homery what she did because there was no not awkward way to ask it. "Do you work?" I once asked a woman back when I had a job. "Of course I work," she said. "I'm a mom." But I was a mom too. So what was what I did called? But also, no one ever had to tell me it was harder to have a job and be a mother. It was obvious. It was two full-time occupations. It's just math. Because having a job made you no less of a mother, you still had to do all that stuff, too. Keeping track of your kids from afar isn't easier. Entrusting them to a stranger who was available for babysitting by virtue of the fact that she was incapable of doing anything else is not something that fills a person with faith and relaxation. Now that I've worked and stayed at home, I can confirm all of this. Now that I stay at home, I can say it out loud. But now that I don't work, no one is listening. No one listens to stay-at-home mothers, which I guess is why we were so careful about their feelings in the first place.
You know, I can really identify with that.
Tell me.
I stayed at home with my children for 14 years.
What?
My son will be 59 years old
really?
In September. So that right. was another generation. And all the women around me stayed home. But that did not mean we didn't go crazy.
Right. Right. Everyone thinks of it as a simpler time.
I mean,
and
really?
I can't fathom how miserable.
And I had no car to drive for 3 years.
Really?
3 years I was in that house. And then when the second child came, I said, "Look, times have got to change." And finally they did. But golly day, I mean, it's a hard thing to do.
You know, when I say I can't fathom it, I can't fathom not having the choice. Although I think the choice is the crippling thing, because I think there are times when there's no choice but to stay home with the children. And I think there are times when there's no choice but to work. I'm married to a journalist. I have no choice but to work, and I very happily work. But my mother always says to me, I always say how guilty I feel leaving the children. And she always says to me, you know, just because you enjoy it, and just because you're good at it doesn't mean you don't have to do it. And that makes me feel better.
So for you, what was that stay-at-home period like after your children were born?
Well, you're making an assumption that I'm the narrator in this book. That said, I had 1 year where I stayed home for one year. And I had this time in which I did not know where to put forward motion. Everything took so long. All these women would come up to me and say, they'd see me holding my baby and they'd say, "Oh, it goes so fast. Enjoy it." And I resented that so much because, like, what is that? Are you supposed to bank the enjoyment? But also, It was not going fast. I wish someone could have said to me, don't worry, this part will be over soon. I love having an 8 and 11-year-old, but I was not great with babies. Yeah. I loved them. But if you're not great with babies, all you can think lurking in the back of your mind is, it must be that I'm not good at being a mother. My life used to be really exciting. I used to go to the movies. My life wasn't even that exciting. It's that the things that I was now preempted from doing, and that's the work of bringing other people into the world. You know, that's the work. I regret it not at all. That's maybe the point of the book. It's that it may be rigorous. It may fill you with dread. A lot of things. Marriage, everything. It may be awful at some points, but it's like that saying about democracy, the worst form of government other than all the other forms of government, right? That said, I'm a very happily married woman.
Yeah,
I would like to say
and
that.
You are happily married.
And it's not an accident that I wrote this book right when we had been married for 13 years. I mean, when my parents got divorced in their 13th year, and there's something about this moment right now that feels like I'm through the looking glass. But I also think people don't talk about marriage enough. They don't talk about their marriages enough because there's something about not wanting the people to know your business. And I think we do ourselves this great I don't know how to fix it, but we do ourselves this great disservice because everyone else's marriages are these locked boxes and we don't know if we're doing them well.
And therefore, we don't know what to expect when we as young people go into marriage.
Right.
I mean, is it supposed to be perfect?
Yeah.
Are there supposed to be no arguments?
Yeah.
Are there supposed to be just heavenly day after day after
right.
day?
Or is it more like regular life where every time you have a triumph, you look to the person who's closest to you and assume that they are part of the triumph? And every time you have a disaster, you look at the person close to you and say, are you part of this disaster? And it's just too easy to blame other people for the problems. A remarkable thing about every single person who has come to me and told me that they were getting divorced is that, you know, I was at their weddings. I thought their weddings were the most beautiful things in the world. I was sometimes very shocked.
And yet, I've read that you've said somewhere that you can tell.
Oh, I can predict, yes.
How come?
I read something a few years ago about a man who could predict divorce within 30 seconds of being in a room with people. And I think, maybe I'm conflating things, but I think that the thing that he talked about was contempt. If he can see any contempt between people, he knows that there's no future for them.
No hope.
Yeah, because contempt is a bridge too far. That said, I don't even agree with that anymore. Like what I now think about marriage and divorce is how much can you tolerate? You know, if I come home and I'm in a terrible mood and if I sound contemptuous, how much can you tolerate me being like that? How much fighting can you tolerate? That's the thing people should be asking themselves before they get married. Are you someone who cannot take a lot of drama? Are you someone who cannot take a lot of arguments? Because sometimes it's that makes a person withdraw.
But do you think that young men and women, and I'm happy that they're getting married later and later as opposed to early.
Right.
Do you think that men and women really think that way before they get married? I think
no.
If you have greater maturity, you can think, well, how much can this person take of this or that?
Well, I have opposing theories here.
Okay.
So the young person's theory, I'm just trying this out here. So please,
good.
Luckily, I'm sure no one's listening. So I think younger people are more susceptible to the spell that love puts you under,
right.
Which I think is this evolutionary device designed to make you stop thinking and do the thing you need to do to be with this person forever and then work things out. But I think as you get older and you know yourself more and more, what happens is that you choose somebody who completes your inadequacies.
Absolutely.
And once they complete your inadequacy, you feel strong and capable, and then you remember why you're how you are and not how the other person is. If someone is very outgoing and confrontational and you are shy and non-confrontational, you may get something real out of the fact that that person will confront on your behalf. However, on the other hand, once that need is filled in you, you're married to someone who goes around confronting people, which is really opposed to your personality. So what do you do then? You know, I don't know.
You may get a divorce.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I have all
exactly.
these questions. I just think it's such a taboo subject. Like the question of how does a marriage work and how can we keep them working is not really a question I ever hear answered, except in the most extreme circumstances, except when there's a disaster and there's like emergency couples therapy, or you seek the advice of a pastor or a rabbi, or you go to one of those very fancy couples retreats that I would love to one day do a story on.
So by the time you finished this book, and now you're out and about talking with everyone and they're reacting to the book, what ideas have you come away with about marriage in general different from those you had before?
You know, while I was writing the book, there's something people do with writers. People tell you their stories. And when I would tell people I'm working on a divorce novel, they would tell me the stories of their divorces.
Wow.
And a lot of those stories are in here. A lot of, you know, I'm very grateful to people who trusted me with that kind of information. And it was always painful to talk about. But what I did learn was that we have very traditional ways of either being married or being divorced. And then there's some kinds of creative people. You know, I did a story about Gwyneth Paltrow. People were so hard on her about her conscious uncoupling, right? Remember her special kind of divorce where they decide that, you know, life is long, they've given each other what they can, and it's time to move on. And I remember talking to her about that. And she said to me, like, I don't understand why everyone was so angry about that. And I said, I think it's because you made your divorce seem even better than their marriages. And she said, my divorce, it was awful. I was getting divorced. How could people not understand that? And I was in her home and I was watching her ex-husband. Her fiance was there, her ex-husband was there, and he was giving music lessons to the kids. And I thought to myself how jealous I was that my parents could not put their animosity aside to do something in our best interest. But I begrudged nobody the right to be creative about something as traditional and old as marriage. I know people in open marriages. I know people who remarry people that they divorced. I know people who every 10 years decide whether or not they still want to be married. I know people who do that. I mean, it really opens up the world to you. And it makes me realize just how kind of to be around that kind of creativity is very interesting.
Taffy, it's a great book. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
I love your show.
Thank you. And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Josephine Neonai and Natalie Urib-Lemker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.